Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The story of access to education for African Americans is rooted in slavery, racism, and oppression. Denying access to education was a tool used by slave owners. In order to continue exploiting black bodies, they had to prevent blacks from learning, reading, and thinking. That's what they tried to do. But blacks revolted and put their lives on the line for the right to an education. By the late 1800s, there were over 86 black colleges in the United States. Between 1866 and 1872, approximately 20,000 whites and blacks in the South were killed, all because of a perceived threat that education would unlock something. And that's exactly what happened. In his new documentary, Tell Them We Are Rising, filmmaker Stanley Nelson explores how historically black colleges and universities changed the course of American history and became institutions of self-empowerment for African-American communities. Stanley Nelson is an award-winning filmmaker with more than a dozen documentaries. He's also founder of Fireflight Media, a nonprofit production company that uses historical films to advance social justice. You can watch Tell Them We Are Rising online for the next couple of weeks, and you can find the link at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Stanley. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us. I loved this film. I'm so glad you made it. I hope every teacher across the country shows this film to their students. Your parents went to historically black universities. What did you know about these schools before you started this project?
Well, I mean, I knew a little bit because both my parents went to HBCUs. I actually went to an HBCU for a short time in my college career. And I taught at Howard University for a little bit, and I also taught at Morgan State. So I knew a little bit, but I didn't know the history. You know, I knew what they were about. I knew the feeling that HBCUs had, but I didn't know the history. So I learned a lot while I was making the film.
I mean, it was amazing, the number of historians that you interviewed and all of the rich information they shared. When you started this project, how did you go about deciding, you know, what angle to take, what the kind of information to bring in? Can you just talk about the process involved?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, this was a difficult film to make because, mm-hmm. you know, we were covering about 170 years worth of history, you know, in 90 minutes. So I think the first decision that we made was that, you know, we wanted to tell stories, that we wanted to tell stories with characters, and that, you know, there are going to be a bunch of schools that you know, we're not going to be able to name, we're not going to be able to tell their story. But we didn't want it to be just a laundry list of schools or, that kind of film. We wanted it to really be a film with stories and exciting stories, you know, throughout this history. And so then we started looking for what are those, kind of landmark stories. What are the stories that we have to tell, the stories that kind of move the general narrative forward. And you know, one story led to the next, and you know, we didn't want all the stories to be at one school. We wanted it to have a diversity of stories, a diversity of schools. And we just started putting it together. I mean, part of it is that, you know, we were looking for stories that we could tell. We started out, you know, during the time of enslavement, and we go to the founding of the first school. So, you know, we're looking for stories where there are pictures, where there's footage, where there's great witnesses as we go forward.
Well, let's talk about that. As you said, trying to tell 170 years of history in one film, but you did an amazing job. You start off with a number of historians talking about how slavery was more brutal than anyone can imagine. And historian Mary Beth Gassman told you that there was a brutality of ignorance, keeping intellectual thought, learning, reading, and knowledge from slaves was the goal of white slave owners. The more a system denies you the chance to read and write, the more reading and writing becomes valuable and precious. And then you also spoke with Kimberly Crenshaw, executive director of the African American Policy Forum, about slaveholders doing whatever he wanted to a slave and knowing that an educated black population could not be an enslaved black population. Talk a little bit about what stood out the most for you in those conversations.
Well, I mean, I think one was just to try to, you know, wrap our heads around the fact that You know, the time of enslavement for African Americans went on for hundreds of years. I mean, this is something, you know, that started in the 1600s and didn't end until the 1800s. So, you know, it went on for hundreds of years. And that, you know, if you think about, you know, denying someone education, you know, so then all that you know is the plantation that you live on and the surrounding area. So, all you know, you can't read, you can't write. There's no schools. The only information that's coming in is, you know, what people are talking about and whispering about. So after a couple of generations, you know, you lose sight of the fact that there's an Africa. You don't know that there's a Europe. You don't know that there's a China. You know, they're trying to keep even the fact that there's a North where slavery is not an institution from you. So, you know, just to kind of put yourself in that head, you know, that this is what slaves were going through, and this is what the lack of education can do. You know, there's a line in the film where one of the historians says that, you know, when black people saw white people reading, they called it talking to books. You know, and on most plantations, very few people knew how to read and write. In fact, it was illegal for not only to learn to read and write, but it was illegal for a master, a so-called master, to teach his enslaved people how to read and write. Those were laws on the books throughout the South.
Mm. Historians also pointed out that this wasn't just happening in the South, because abolitionists at one point wanted to start a college for blacks in New Haven, Connecticut, and officials at Yale University said, no, that's not happening here.
Yeah, I think it was really important for us to tell that story, because, you know, the historian, one of the historians, you know, telling that story says, you know, it wasn't just in the South. You know, we want to think it was in the South, but no, it was illegal in most places, you know, even in the North, for African Americans to read and write it. And you know, what's so amazing about that story is this is New Haven, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. You know, this is New England. And a group of African Americans wanted to just set up a college. And basically the town rose up and said no. And there's a fantastic document in the film that we read that was written by the mayor that says, you know, no, this would ruin our town. Mm. It would ruin our town if we tried to have a college here for African Americans. And this is, again, in New Haven.
Mm. And lower the town's public morals.
Right.
And then as the war broke out, African Americans fled the plantation, and once they got behind the Union lines, they wanted to get an education. And these were referred to as contraband schools. So at night, they went to these contraband schools?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we loved, and we really wanted to get that term in there, you know, is the formerly enslaved people who would escape. I mean, as soon as they could, when the Civil War started, as soon as they could, they would escape behind Union lines. I mean, nobody wants to be a slave, mm-hmm. you know, and so they would escape behind Union lines. And in some ways, Union Army didn't know what to do with them. So they called them contraband. You know, they are contraband of war. They were, you know, there's this thing that had been taken from war, and they started schools. Because one of the things that you know, happens when you're denied an education, you know, when you're denied something, is, you know, you're like, well, why am I denied this? What is this thing mm-hmm. that I'm denied? You know, and let me try to get this thing. Let me try to see what it is. So education became extremely important, you know, even during the war for African Americans, and then after the war, of course.
Today we're speaking with Stanley Nelson, an award-winning filmmaker. His new documentary is called Tell Them We Are Rising. It explores how historically black colleges and universities, called HBCUs, changed the course of American history and became institutions of self-empowerment for African American communities. It's an incredible documentary. If you're an educator or you know one, please tell them about this film and ask them to show it in the classroom. You can watch it online on PBS through Independent Lens through March 21st, and you can find the trailer and the link at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. If you have connections to HBCUs, if you attended one, if your family attended one, if you have any stories about black colleges, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Leave a comment on our Twitter account at yourcallradio, or tweet us, I should say. You can also leave us a comment at yourcallradio.org. www.ncc.org. All right, so we talked about the contraband schools. This is also really interesting. American missionaries went down to the South to set up schools. And in the film, we learn that they were dedicated to the idea that enslaved people needed to be, quote, civilized.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, the missionaries that went down from the North to the South, I mean, you know, they were extremely brave and extremely dedicated. As you said, you know, 20,000 people, you know, mostly African Americans, but many whites were killed, you know, for just providing education. So they were extremely dedicated people, but they had their idea was that African Americans needed to be civilized. That African Americans, many of them, felt that, you know, African Americans could learn, but only to a limited degree. And that one of the things that they were doing besides educating was Christianizing African Americans, and that was really one of their purposes, was to not only educate these formerly enslaved people, but to make them, you know, better Christians. So it was an education, but it was an education with a very religious slant to it. Mm-hmm.
And then what happened when the African Methodist Episcopal Church got in and said, wait a minute, we want our own education systems?
Right. I mean, you know, well, the African Methodist Episcopal Church is a very powerful black church, and you know, they went to the South and started educating in their own way, and said, you know, we should control our own education. You know, we couldn't control anything during the time of enslavement in the South, but now we can. And so, you know, they started setting up schools, and other churches started setting up schools that were, you know, much more kind of from an African American slant.
And then the federal government set up black colleges also. And in the film, we learn that by the late 1800s, there were over 86 black colleges. How did plantation owners respond to all of this?
Well, you know, the plantation owners in the South really didn't want people to be educated. And you know, what's really interesting about it is that they didn't want African Americans to be educated, but they didn't want white Americans, you know, poor Southerners to be educated either. I mean, they wanted an uneducated, you know, workforce out in the fields. And so they reacted strongly. Again, many people were killed. Schools were burned down. There's an incredible section in the film. There's a story of a white guy who goes down to Alabama, and he's going to be lynched. Because he's teaching African Americans to read and write, and this is after, you know, slavery, and they give him a chance to write a letter home, and he writes a letter to his wife that says, you know, my dear, I die tonight, and that's how the letter starts, and he actually was hung and killed for simply going down there and teaching people to read and write.
I mean, that was an amazing part of the film. How did you find that piece of information?
It was something we came across. I can't remember exactly how we came across his letter, but we came across it, and it was just, you know, so moving, and just kind of said so much right there that we knew immediately that was something that we wanted to use.
I mean, this fact also is mind-blowing. I mean, it's not surprising, but when you think about kind of drilling down, when you look at the murders of whites and blacks, specifically just about education, again, between 1866 and 1872, approximately 20,000 whites and blacks, mostly blacks in the South, were killed because of a perceived threat that education would unlock something. And that's what we learn in the new documentary, Tell Them We Are Rising, by today's guest, filmmaker Stanley Nelson. It explores how historically black colleges and universities changed the course of American history. And you can watch it online until March 21st. And let's go to a few callers. Let's hear from William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. I am so thankful that the guest used the term escape rather than runaway. I have always felt that there was an intrinsic denigration of slaves when they were described as running away rather than escaping bondage. And finally, someone has used the appropriate phrase. I wondered whether the guest, having certainly heard the phrase runaway in the past, felt that there was a significance in the distinction in the use of the words escape and run away.
All right. Thank you, William. Stanley?
Yeah, I mean, I do, and I think a lot of our terminology about that we use for that time, you know, has to be thought about and changed. You know, one thing that scholars and historians are using more and more is, you know, enslavement, you know, enslaved people, the time of enslavement rather than slaves. You know, these people weren't enslaved. They were not slaves. You know, they were enslaved. One of the things that I just started thinking about that I find to be really interesting is we talk about, you know, people who were involved in the slave trade, you know, the guys who went to Africa and were on the boats. We talk about them as slavers, you know, but we don't talk about the people who owned slaves, who owned enslaved people. We don't talk about them as slavers. We talk about them as slaveholders, which is a much more benign term. You know, they were just kind of holding slaves. They just happened to have some. But they were slavers.
Mm.
You know, they were slavers. But as you said, Mary Beth Gassman talks about, you know, the brutality of slavery, and you know, that slavery was held in place, that this system was held in place by brutality. That was, you know, daily and daily brutality. That was what slavery was characterized by.
Well,
I think it's really important that we start, you know, thinking about it and using terminology that accurately, or tries to in some ways accurately represent what this thing actually was.
It's such a good point. Slave owners, plantation owners is even worse than slave owners, because you just think of someone on a farm. I mean, obviously the word plantation brings up a lot of images, but
right.
Slavers.
Mint julep and there, you know, and just relaxing a while, you know, some people work in the field and stuff like that. The film that I'm working on next is about the slave trade, and one of the things that we just had a conference on, one of the startling things that was said to us was that, you know, only 5% or so of women, of African-American women, worked in the house. So 95% of African-American women worked in the field, doing the same back-breaking work that the men were doing.
Wow. Thank you so much for the call, William. Let's go next to Phil in San Francisco. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Ms. Aguilar, and good morning, Mr. Nelson.
Good morning.
I'm a native Californian, and my father, son of a school teacher, as in my father was with Oakland Public Schools in the 20th century. And so here we are in the 21st century. So one item is, where do you see funding for public education going? And then two, I wish to compliment KLW on broadening our horizons in education for bringing on knowing about Brown University and the other institutions in New England that made links to the people that were then sent to the South and, you know, are now returning for scholarships in upper education.
Well, thank you for that. Here's one fact that is connected to your question, Phil. African Americans are still shut out of educational opportunities because of major funding disparities. In 2013, Essence reported that if the endowments of all 105 HBCUs were added up, they would still amount to less than 10% of Harvard University's endowment. So what about that, Stanley? What about the funding issue and just access to education even today?
I mean, I think that's a huge issue. It's something that we've come across over and over again as we've traveled around with this film. Actually, you know, we did this little thing, a little 10-minute documentary that you can see at New York Times OpDoc. It's called Black Colleges in the Age of Trump. And it's a really interesting little piece, and I recommend anybody go online, and again, it's New York Times OpDoc. Because one of the things that's happened is that, you know, in the past year and a half almost that we've had this Trump administration, black colleges have been in the news probably more than they have been in the 20 years before that. You know, from Talladega, which is my mother's alma mater, playing at Trump's inauguration, to the presidents of HBCUs going to the White House, to Betsy DeVos's constant gaffes. So I think it's really interesting. And one of the things that we say in this little doc, and I think one of the things we have to understand is that so many black colleges, as you said, you know, exist on the margins. You know, they don't have large endowments. They exist with federal funding. It's really important to them. And so the presidents in so many cases are kind of existing between a rock and a hard place because they need federal money to survive. But, you know, the Trump administration is so toxic to the African-American community. So it makes for a very interesting situation.
Yes, well, thank you for calling in, Phil. And then, of course, we have all of the budget problems in high school and middle school, public schools, which we did a show about a couple of weeks ago. And we'll
I mean, that's something I just want to jump in here.
Yeah.
That's something that I think so many people, you know, don't understand is that, you know, in so many communities around this country, high school, grade school, junior high school funding is based on the tax dollars of the community. So, you know, poorer neighborhoods get poorer schools, you know, and it goes on and on. That's just the way education is at this point in this country. And so HBCUs still serve an incredible function.
Yeah, there have been a lot of articles, Stanley, about how education is still separate and unequal today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, if we open our eyes and look around, I think that, you know, besides maybe, you know, Sunday, you know, at church, you know, there's no place that's as segregated as education. You know, if you get, you know, if you go by a schoolyard, you know, during recess, you know, you see it where, you know, anywhere in this country, and so that's the system that we live under at this point. And, you know, we're hoping that one of the things that happens is that system continues to evolve and change.
Well, thank you for the call, Phil. Let's go next to Deborah in San Francisco. Hi, Deborah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I just saw this film last night on PBS, and it was really well done and really informative. I honestly didn't know anything about the history between E.B.W. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, and the total perspective that it gave of the vision of the usefulness of these black colleges for educating individuals for different careers, and how the Booker T. Washington model kept basically white industrialists placated and funding a lower educational standard and career path for the educated black population. And it was just really well done, fascinating, fantastic film clips. As you said, I would recommend it to anyone who wanted to learn more about this. It was just a very, very well done documentary. But in addition, while I was waiting, I moved here from Key West, Florida after Hurricane Wilma sort of wiped me out. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to mention to the filmmaker, as he's looking into slavery information for his next documentary, that Key West had captured, or rather troops had captured, the last slaving ship. And there's abundant records of individuals that were taken off of that ship and kept for months in Key West and fed and clothed and kept there before they were sent back to Africa, to, I believe, Liberia. And they were able to uncover an African graveyard that was for some of the people who didn't survive after the trip, and all kinds of really interesting information. So I wanted to sort of point him in the direction so that he could get sort of the last remaining information about a slave. It was after slavery was abolished, they still were able to capture a ship that was transporting African slaves.
Hmm. Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Deborah. And I'm glad you brought up the differences between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois. And we'll talk about that with Stanley Nelson right after the break. We're talking today about Stanley Nelson's new film, Tell Them We Are Rising. It explores how historically black colleges and universities changed the course of American history. You can watch it online until March 21st, and you can find the link at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about immigration detention centers. Last week, ICE detained 150 people in Northern California. ICE says 800 more were spared after Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf warned the public of possible arrests. The Supreme Court recently ruled that immigrants can be detained indefinitely without a hearing. So what happens after immigrants are arrested? What are their conditions like and how are they treated? That is tomorrow. Friday, it's our media roundtable. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's show, we're talking with filmmaker Stanley Nelson about his newest documentary, Tell Them We Are Rising. It looks at historically black colleges and universities. They changed the course of history and became institutions of self-empowerment for African-American communities. And in fact, they still are today. We will play a couple of clips later in the show from young people who talk about why they decided to go to a black college. If you have any questions or comments for Stanley, if you went to a black college, if you're connected to one, we'd love to hear from you, or just a general question. The history is so rich in this film. 866-798-8255. You can tweet us at Your Call Radio. You can leave a comment on our website, or you can email us, yourcall@kalw.org. Stanley, let's talk about the tension and the differences between Booker T. Washington's approach to education versus W.E.B. Du Bois. This was a fascinating part of your film.
Yeah, it's really funny because that's in, you know, we show the film. That's one of the things that people want to talk about the most. In making the film, I didn't think it was that spectacular, but people really I think are stunned by it. I think that still, you know, Booker T. Washington is taught as this great hero, and he was. I mean, he did great things. He built Tuskegee from scratch, and some other grade schools and did some great things, but you know what he was preaching was this idea that African Americans should be educated in what was called an industrial education, which was really kind of to be a great craftsman, a great bricklayer or carpenter, leather worker, and things like that, which we need. I think the problem with Booker T. was that Southern planters, rich Southern planters, and Northern industrialists picked up on what he was saying, and said, "Great, that's great. Let's pour money into Booker T. Let's pour money into Tuskegee. Let's make this education for what education should be for African Americans." Because it sounded so good. We're gonna educate black people for service, as somebody says in the film. One of the historians, he was basically preaching an idea of neo-slavery for African Americans, it sounded really good, and W.E.B. Du Bois and other scholars kind of jumped in, and said, "Wait a minute, we need to be educated in the same way that white folks are educated. We need to learn the classics and language and math and history and those things, and that's what we should be pushing. That's what we should be pushing for: equal education, not this kind of lesser education."
And W.E.B. Du Bois's daughter went to the school and found out about how this was being taught and what was being pushed. This was really interesting, the speech that he gave.
Yeah, well, W.E.B. Du Bois' daughter goes, Yolanda goes to Fisk University, where actually Du Bois had graduated from Fisk, and she goes to Fisk, and they have a white president who just draws a hard line and says, You know, maybe men and women shouldn't even walk next to each other. Maybe just, you know, let's do away at the baseball team and the football team and, you know, all the fraternities and sororities and the students. And then he kind of makes the mistake of inviting Du Bois there to speak at graduation. And you know, W.B. Du Bois, as anybody knows who knows anything about him, was always a fiery speaker, always a fiery individual, who, you know, said what was on his mind. And he, instead of saying the usual graduation speech of, you know, go out in the world and conquer, he starts out his speech with, you know, I'm here to preach resistance, you know, and he goes on to give this rousing speech, and the students then have like a mini riot and go on strike, and it's the first time that's ever happened. And they won't go to class. They don't go to class for weeks until the president is finally replaced.
And like Fisk, most black colleges at that time had white presidents who were, you know, ill-equipped as to what to do with, as historians said, with African Americans who wanted to shape their own destiny. Let's hear a clip from the film "Tell Them We Are Rising." This is historian Mary Beth Gassman talking about Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, in 1924.
To get them,
black colleges were an interesting place. Most of them, during that period, had white presidents. And they were run in a very draconian kind of way, with moral codes and with lots of rules. The white presidents were completely ill-equipped as to what to do with these African Americans who now wanted to shape their own destiny and were very spirited and were defiant.
Mackenzie, the Fisk University president, is not the kind of person that she would have expected to come to Fisk. He had worked out west on Shoshone Indian reservations, and he had an extensive experience with Native American white relations. The Board of Trustees of Fisk made no real distinction between working with Native Americans and working with African Americans. His white secretary commented that she didn't think that he understood black people and wasn't even sure that he liked them.
That is a clip from the documentary "Tell Them We Are Rising" by today's guest, Stanley Nelson. You can watch it online on PBS through Independent Lens through March 21st. You know, when I watched this clip, Stanley, I was wondering, what did he mean when he said he was working with Native Americans? I mean, that could go so many different ways.
Well, I forgot what exactly his position was, but he was one of those kind of commissioners of Indian Affairs. I think he worked for the Office of Indian Affairs out west. But, you know, I love that line because, you know, what they're saying is, you know, they, you know, if he can work with Indians, he can work with black folks, you know. he actually wasn't really prepared to work with either one.
Hmm. And it's so interesting because so many of the students who graduated from these schools, went to these schools, were so empowered. They realized that they could really change the course of history. At what point did you see that shift happening?
You know, I think, you know, in the 30s and 40s. So what we wanted to do was set up with the strike at Fisk that now the students are kind of taking control of their own destinies. They're saying, you know, we want these schools to be more, you know, to be more focused on who we actually are. We want these schools to be centered on us, and that, you know, then leads to you know, this kind of golden age that we talk about in the 30s and 40s, and then, you know, after that, we, you know, in the 50s and early 60s, as we go into the civil rights movement, the students become leaders, you know, in the civil rights movement. We talk about the sit-ins that came out of North Carolina A&T and then spread to other schools all over the South. But, you know, that when you think about it, that's natural. I mean, you know, one, you know, movements are led by young people. And these schools were the only kind of safe intellectual space that African Americans had. You know, so you have, you know, four guys at North Carolina A&T are sitting around the dorm room and saying, you know, it's ridiculous that we can't sit down at Woolworths and eat, You know, they'll let us take food out, they'll let us buy stuff, but we can't, they won't let us sit down and eat. So let's just go down there and sit there. And we'll sit there until they serve us or until we get arrested. We're just going to sit there. And this leads to a movement that's sit-in movement that spreads all over South, mainly propelled by African-American students.
Hmm. I mean, this just completely took off. I mean, so many people know of the lunch counter protest. Remind me where the first one took place?
Yeah, at North Carolina A&T.
And then from there, it just completely took off.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, students joined in North Carolina and in other states and Atlanta. And it really just spread throughout the South because, you know, one of the interesting things about the whole sit-in movement is it happened really quickly because it was an economic movement. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't about culture. It was about, you know, one of the things that is interesting about the civil rights movement is the movements that had to do with economics mm-hmm. changed very quickly. So the bus boycott, you know, a Montgomery bus boycott, it took a year, more than a year. But, you know, once it changed, you know, because it was about money. Mm-hmm. You know, the sit-ins was about money, you know. These stores were losing money. You know, not only were the students sitting in, but they were, you know, the people were in the stores, you know, fighting and arguing. You know, older black people stopped shopping in these stores. And so it was costing them money, and you know, in some ways, very quickly that changed. As White South used to talk about, that custom in the South changed.
Today we're speaking with Stanley Nelson, an award-winning filmmaker with more than a dozen documentaries. We had Stanley on to talk about his past documentary, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. You can watch that one. It's available now. And his newest one, Tell Them We Are Rising, explores how historically black colleges and universities changed the course of American history. I'm sorry for those pops that you're hearing. I'm not sure what that's about, something on the line, but sorry about that popping sound. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. You can watch this documentary online through March 21st. Let's hear from Summer in Berkeley. Hi, Summer. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. In fact, thank you both for your work. I'm very familiar with Mr. Nelson's films, and I listen to your program all the time. I just wanted to make a comment about how these historical black colleges played such a important and beautiful role during the Jewish Holocaust, because there were many academics in Nazi Germany, both before the war and then in parts of Europe that had been taken over by Nazis, that couldn't get academic placement in American universities. The most prestigious universities in the United States turned them all down, but they found places in academia in historical black colleges and universities. And this is documented in a wonderful book called From Swastika to Jim Crow, because they found themselves transported to places where the prejudice, the bias, the racism, the anti-Semitism was so intense, and they lived in these isolated places around the colleges themselves.
Stanley? Are you familiar with that? Did you come across that?
Yeah, no, that's something that is definitely true. It's something that we didn't investigate. We just, you know, we just weren't able to really cover that in the film. You know, one of the things that was so amazing about this film is that look, you can make 30 more films about black colleges and universities. You know, you can make 30 more great films about black colleges and universities and you know, still not cover everything. So we knew that. But there were great stories like the one that was just told, you know, about Jewish scholars who did in the 30s and 40s, you know, find a home and find a place at black colleges and were part of the golden age of black colleges all across this country.
Mm-hmm. You know, across the country.
You know, one of the things that's interesting is, you know, my parents both went to the black colleges in the 30s and 40s, and those were the only place they could go, mm-hmm. you know. So, you know, not only did you have you know, the Jewish scholars coming from Europe, but also black scholars in this country, no matter where they were educated, the very few that were able to go to Harvard or Yale or Oberlin or the few liberal schools that they could go to, they were not able to get teaching positions in those schools. by and large. So they taught at black colleges.
Mm. And in the film, we hear from Dorothy Smith, a Bennett College student, and she talks about how her excellent high school grades got her a recommendation to attend Wilson College, and she explains why she wasn't able to go to Wilson College. This is a clip from the new documentary, Tell Them We Are Rising.
In high school, I was a good student. That's why I guess the principal is recommending me to Wilson College. The disappointment comes when that person comes from the college to interview me, and then it was all downhill. I have not forgotten her words. Your grades are wonderful, but we're a little concerned because we don't know with whom you would be paired, because we cater to a lot of Southern gentle women, and they room in suites. Sorry, kid. So I didn't get to Wilson. I applied to Bennett for a scholarship. It was kind of special. You know, you kind of stick your chest out. I'm a Bennett gal.
That's Dorothy Smith, a clip in the new documentary, Tell Them We Are Rising. Stanley, what the other thing I loved is, you know, as this is like a journalist's dream to be able to interview all of these amazing people. The historians were incredible, but then people like Dorothy, who lived through this experience. What was that like for you?
Yeah, that's one of the greatest parts for me of making films, is I get to talk to and interview, people who I never would have gotten to meet, you know, any other way. And a lot of times, you know, what's so great is nobody's asked them about their story, you know, in years. And so they're just so excited to be able to you know, tell their story. We interview another couple in that same section who meet, you know, in the 30s, I guess it is, 40s, you know, at a black college. And they are in their 90s, you know, and they talk about how they met, you know, at the black college, and they're just their story is just so beautiful, and it's so cute. And you know, he ends with 68 years ago we were married. You know, it's just, just an incredible piece, and just to be able to talk to people and let them tell their stories is really one of the great gifts that I've been given.
Have you been able to watch the movie with any of the people who were in the movie, and what were their reactions?
Yeah, a lot of people have come to different screenings. They've been great. They've just been, you know, wonderful. You know, we've done a number of screenings all over the country, so it's been great. I mean, you know, one of the things is wonderful is to hear people's reaction to seeing themselves on screen and seeing their stories told.
We have a question on Facebook from Sarah, who says, can you please mention some of the leadership positions in our country from former students who benefited from black colleges? You know, some of the scenes in the film were just such a pleasure to watch, because you have these students in suits and ties and women in these beautiful dresses with these fitted, beautiful jackets, taking science classes, law classes, math classes, writing. I mean, it was just interesting to see that.
Yeah, I think one of the great things that worked for this film are the, you know, the great footage and the great pictures, you know. You know, if you think about it, you know, these schools basically started right after the Civil War, you know, and what the colleges do and universities, you know, they take pictures, right? They take pictures of the graduating class. They take pictures, inside the classrooms. So we found just incredible pictures and incredible footage that's never been seen before. You know, the sports teams, the baseball team from 1910 or something at Morris Brown, you know, the graduating class, you know, from Fisk in 1890, you know, those kind of things. So just great, great, great pictures that, frankly, you know, were one of the things that made me start thinking very seriously about this film, was that, you know, I knew it was a great story of this incredible institution that changed, you know, lives of African Americans and changed the lives, you know, of all Americans. But I've been, you know, thought, well, this is a story we can tell because there are these great pictures, there's this great footage. Mm-hmm. We can tell this story, and we can tell it in a way that is going to be really exciting.
Let's go next to Dee in Oakland. Hi, Dee. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, and thank you both again for your work. The question, the statement I want to make is that I love the perspective of the film, because the perspective of the film, to me, comes from an African-American perspective of society development, you know, colleges and universities and people that came out of historic Black institutions were the pillars of our society on all levels, in politics and in commerce. And also the theme that runs through the film, thank you so much for, is the one that Black people always wanted to educate and empower and develop their own sense of community, that various parts where we have to take back and wrestle back our education, which we are in the middle of now in terms of how do you tell your story and how do you see your sense of community development. So just thank you, and all of your work does that. It gives our perspective from an African-American perspective, and I appreciate that because the material is not new, but this perspective is.
Yeah, so thank you so much. And going back to Sarah's question, which I'm sorry we really didn't answer, it kind of related to what Dee was talking about. As your film explores Stanley, these young people went on to become, I mean, can you talk about that? Lawyers, academics. Can you just talk about what some of these students went on to do with their lives?
Yeah, I mean, there's been no greater catalyst into the middle class than Black colleges and universities. I mean, one way to look at it is, you know, until the end of the 1960s or so, you know, 95% of Black folks who went to college or university went to Black colleges and universities. I mean, that, you know, that's just how it was. So, you know, anybody that graduated college before then, you know, went to a Black college or university. So, you know, you're talking about anybody from W.E.B. Du Bois to Martin Luther King. Mm-hmm. There was no other place to go. And so they've just been instrumental in that. And still today, you know, Black colleges and universities graduate an outsized number of doctors and lawyers and judges, you know, way over the percentage of students that are enrolled there.
And these issues are still very relevant today. I want to play another clip from a young woman today who talks about what it was like to go through school never having a Black teacher.
All your stuff gonna get in here.
At my high school, I was a token Black girl. That was something very hard for me. You're either the ratchet Black ghetto person or you're the exception. You're the high achieving, excellent, that's what you are. And I'm tired of those boxes. I don't wanna be one thing or the other. I wanna be me. I wanna have the opportunity to discover myself.
And I actually got that clip wrong, but that was another great clip. But there is another one also about a young girl who said that in her entire K-12 education, she never had a Black teacher. She used to ask her mom when she would finally have a Black teacher. And she talks about just the impact it has when you're the only Black girl in school. And she went on to go to an HBCU.
Yeah, it's really a funny thing that happens, you know, so much in our society. You know, I was at a screening, and somebody asked a question, and this was a screening with mainly white folks, and I said, you know, who in here, raise your hand if you've ever in your life been in a room where you're like the only white person, you know, everybody else is Black, and one person raised their hand, you know. I was at another screening a couple of days ago, and with mostly African Americans, and I was talking about that other screening, and I said, you know, to the audience, you know, so if you for all the Black people in the audience, raise your hand if you've ever been in a situation where you're the only Black person in a room, and actually the audience broke out in laughter, and every single person in the room raised their hand. So you know that's, you know, and sometimes, you know, we don't think about that. you know, or the larger society doesn't think about what that experience is like constantly. And I thought that the young women that we profile in the last section, you know, do just a great job of talking about the fact of, you know, just never ever having a black teacher. And that's very common for African-American kids, especially if you're going to a majority white school, is you just don't, you know, you never have a black teacher. And even more for young African-American men, mm-hmm. you never have a black male teacher. Mm-hmm. That's normal.
Yeah. You know, Stanley, how do you see where we are right now? Because, I mean, the racism that we see is just horrific, and it's been heightened by what we see coming out of the White House. The hate crimes are on the rise. At the same time, we have access to so much information now. Documentaries like yours, Confederate statues are being torn down. I mean, it's just, we're in a very interesting time right now. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, interesting would be the word. And, you know, I think we're in a place that for most African Americans we never thought we'd see. But I think it's important, you know, for white people to stay woke, you know, and wake up, you know, and see where we are and think about where we want to go as a country. I mean, that's like to me that's the bottom line. You know, where do we want to be? Who do we want to be as a country? You know, do we want to be, you know, a mean-spirited country that's looking backward? You know, or do we want to be something else? Do we want to be something that's looking forward, you know, into a future that's a lot better than our past?
Mm. Stanley, is this going to be on TV again?
Yeah, it's on PBS and it's on the rotation. I know a lot of stations are using it for Pledge Break, which is amazing for us. But it will be on, you know, on PBS over and over again. I think it's more now, you know, up to local stations. So, you know, check your local listings or check with your local stations. But as you've said over and over, you know, you can get it free. You know, because it's streaming, and that's great. And then afterwards, you know, I mean, now it's actually for sale. You can get it, you know, from PBS.org. I don't know, it's probably $20 or something. But I think it's an important document. I think it's a film that people will want to have in their libraries because, you know, just the visuals are just, you know, it's just incredible. I mean, we do a montage of graduates, you know, in the 1880s, and you know, they're looking so beautiful, and you know, their beautiful gowns and suits, and you know, and then we say, you know, a lot of these people, you know, were formerly enslaved.
Mm. So powerful. Stanley, thank you so much for all of your amazing work. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Stanley Nelson is an award-winning filmmaker. His latest, Tell Them We Are Rising. I hope you can see it. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.